This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Could you imagine being able to create a million, a billion, even $50 billion just by hitting some keystrokes and increasing the balance in a bank account? Well, that's exactly what the Federal Reserve does. And during the nation's financial meltdown, the Fed has created and pumped close to $2 trillion into the nation's banks and financial institutions to keep the economy afloat. Our guest, writer David Wessel, argues that the Fed's aggressive intervention in the crisis may well have prevented a second Great Depression. But because it's been so active and independent, the Fed and its chairman, Ben Bernanke, have become controversial. Many in Congress don't like the idea that the Fed has the authority to create and lend enormous amounts of money on its own without congressional or presidential approval, and there are proposals to increase scrutiny of the Federal Reserve and limit its authority. On the other hand, many economists argue that it's critical for the economy to have a central banking system that is independent and free from political influence. And a proposed revamping of the financial system gives the Fed even more regulatory power. Wessel says the Fed has effectively become a fourth branch of government, and he explores its role in the financial crisis in his new book, In Fed, We Trust. David Wessel is economics editor of The Wall Street Journal. Well, David Wessel, welcome to Fresh Air. In this book, you note that the Federal Reserve has such enormous power and independence, it could be called a fourth branch of government. And I'd like to begin with a naive question, really, and that is, what is a central bank or a national bank? I mean, you know, we all know that commercial banks get deposits from its customers and then takes that money and lends it out to businesses and mortgage holders and then, you know, makes a return. How is a national bank different?
Well, a central bank, which is an old invention, dates to the 17th century in Britain, is really a regulator of credit. And one way to think about it is that if we're going to have paper money, fiat money it's called, somebody has to oversee it. We didn't have to do that when we had barter economies where you traded your cow for somebody else's horseshoes, and you didn't have to do it when people had faith in gold. And if you had gold, you had money, and if you didn't have gold, you didn't have money. So in a very real sense, the Fed stands behind the paper currency. In fact, the paper currency we have are called Federal Reserve notes. The Fed actually runs the printing presses, or these days they're electronic, and it controls how much money there is in the economy.
Now, you noted the book that from, I guess, the 1830s, for the next 75 or 80 years, there really was no central banking system in the United States because there was such suspicion of bankers. But there was a crisis in 1907 that really brought the fragility of the financial system into focus. Tell us about that and how catastrophe was averted then.
Well, that's right. Alexander Hamilton, in the founding of the U.S., wanted to have a central bank, and there was, as you say, the first and the second banks of the United States, both of which blew up. In 1907, there was no central bank. There was a crisis. It started with speculation, actually, on copper in New York. There were a number of banks that were the core of the system, and they kind of took care of each other. And then there were a number of banks on the periphery, and they weren't considered that important, sort of like what we saw during the recent period. Some of those banks on the periphery, they were called trust companies, got into trouble, and there was a panic, a widespread panic. The president, Theodore Roosevelt, was off hunting in Louisiana, and it fell to the only man who had the money and power to hold the system together, J.P. Morgan, to do the job. And at one point during the panic of 1907, one big bank has fallen, another bank is in trouble. J.P. Morgan tries to organize bankers, commercial bankers, to come together and rescue this bank for the good of the system, much as the Federal Reserve did when it called everybody and asked them to help with Bear Stearns in this period, and nobody will come to the party. So he calls the president of the bank and he tells the bank to bring all his best securities to Morgan's office, and Morgan goes through them one at a time until he has enough security, enough collateral, so he feels comfortable in lending the money in order to keep that bank afloat and keep the system from imploding. It was that episode and the days that followed that led both the bankers in New York to feel they couldn't control things by themselves anymore. They needed help from Washington, and Washington to feel it wasn't so healthy to rely on an aging albeit very rich and powerful man, to keep the country out of trouble. And that led to the founding of the Federal Reserve in 1913.
All right. So that led to a commitment to create a central banking system. And you had this tension because there was this perceived need for some stability and regulation. On the other hand, there was this great suspicion of giving bankers commanding positions in the economy. What kind of system resulted? What does the Fed look like today?
Well, there was a lot of tension at that time. There was tension between borrowers and lenders, between city and urban interests on one hand and rural interests on the other. There was a lot of suspicion, as you say, about big bankers. The banks actually wanted to control the Federal Reserve. And Woodrow Wilson and some of his progressive colleagues at the time didn't think that was a good idea. So they ended up with a hybrid. There were 12 regional Federal Reserve banks, each of which was owned by the banks in its own district, technically. And there was a very weak Federal Reserve Board in Washington. And in fact, the strongest player was not in Washington, but it was the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, a man named Benjamin Strong, who had once worked very closely with J.P. Morgan. So that was the structure that we got after World War I that for the next couple of decades was the central bank.
It changed in the 30s, right?
Right. The 30s is a calamity in central bank history. The Fed, operating under what it thought was the orthodox conventional monetary policies of the time, took a bad recession and made it horrendous. It's really incredible to look back and see how badly they handled the thing. As a result of that, Congress revisited the structure of the Fed, and it made the Washington Board of Governors much stronger. So today, we are living with a structure that was created in 1935, where we have 7 Federal Reserve governors in Washington who are appointed by the president, confirmed by the Senate, and 12 regional Fed banks, each of which has a president who is chosen by its private sector board of directors. And together, those two groups of people form a committee that sets interest rates and makes monetary policy. But the Washington directors, the 7, always have the power to outvote the 12 because only 5 of the 12 can vote at any one time.
So we have strong influence of the federal government, but there remain private sector elements to the system, right?
Right. And the idea was to prevent it from being 100% controlled by politicians. Because what the Fed really is a compromise between people who don't trust bankers and people who don't trust politicians. So there's a kind of built-in checks and balances there.
Now, the current chairman of the Federal Reserve is Ben Bernanke, and he was by training an economist, right, who spent a lot of time studying the Great Depression and the role of the Federal Reserve. Tell us his view of what happened, after the stock market crash of 29.
Well, most economists think that the stock market crash of 29 was as much a symptom as a cause of the Depression. The very famous economist Milton Friedman, who won a Nobel Prize, and his colleague Anna Schwartz, who's still alive and in her 90s, wrote a very influential book that blamed the Great Depression on what the Fed did, that the Fed was basically too miserly with credit. Ben Bernanke was a graduate student at MIT, read that book, was very influenced by it, and pursued their line of inquiry to try and understand how was it that such smart people, well-meaning, made such colossal mistakes and created the Great Depression. And Bernanke agrees in part with Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz. He thinks the Fed was too stingy with credit, and he thinks Herbert Hoover made a number of mistakes with tax and spending policy. But he added his own little channel to the discussion of how monetary policy got it so wrong. And what he said was the Fed didn't understand that when banks collapse, that isn't just a symptom of a problem, but that makes the problem worse. Because when banks collapse, they can't lend. Credit is the lifeblood of the economy. It's like the circulatory system of a body shutting down. And so his work emphasized that it wasn't just that the Fed did the wrong thing on interest rates at the wrong time, or that Hoover did the wrong thing on taxes and spending, and that Roosevelt got some things right and some things wrong. It was everybody misunderstood how important the banking system was and how much it was transmitting this economic disease to the whole economy. Well, if you flash forward, you see that that's exactly what happened in our own time. And he was looking for that. A lot of people thought he was nuts at first, that this wasn't a repeat of that kind of thing. But he saw it through that lens, and I think you can understand much of what he does during this great panic through that lens.
Let's talk about the recent calamities, which you have dubbed the Great Panic. First of all, to what extent did the Federal Reserve contribute to this mess by either faulty policies or misreading the situation?
Well, that's a very good question. I think the list of people who blew it is very long and includes everybody from the people who ran the banks and the people who were on their risk management committees to the sophisticated investors that were buying mortgages from people who had no income and didn't have any down payment, to the mortgage brokers who sold those, to the people themselves who bought houses they couldn't afford, to the financial press that didn't blow the whistle or at least not blow it loudly enough. But it's impossible to excuse the Federal Reserve and that long list. And in the book, I talk about some things that I think the Fed, with the benefit of hindsight, and that's important, didn't get quite right during the years when Alan Greenspan was the chairman and Ben Bernanke was a member of the Federal Reserve Board but not in charge. It looks to me like the Fed kept interest rates too low too long because it was worried about a weak economy and about a phenomenon called deflation or falling prices. By keeping interest rates so low, it just encouraged a whole lot of borrowing that led people to speculate wildly and help produce the housing bubble. But more than that, I think that the Fed fell down on its responsibilities to regulate the economy. Ever since the 30s, it has had responsibility for keeping an eye on the banking system, and it did not use the power it had to stop these kind of crazy mortgages that were being made or to sort of curtail the wild borrowing that was going on that later blew up in our faces. And then I think the third thing is that Alan Greenspan, as chairman of the Federal Reserve, believed very strongly that markets left to themselves would sort things out, that if you had a whole lot of rich people, very sophisticated investors playing poker, that those people would have such a strong interest in keeping the poker table honest that there wasn't any point to having a bunch of bureaucratic regulators who were trying to do that job. And that turned out to be wrong, and he's admitted as much in a testimony and before Henry Waxman's committee on the Hill that his worldview was wrong. So keeping interest rates too low too long, not using the regulatory muscle they had, and contributing to this the market can do no wrong attitude are the three things which I think the Fed can be cited for causing or contributing, as you say, contributing to the current crisis.
When this crisis emerged, I mean, we saw, you know, problems with mortgage-backed securities, and then I guess the first big bank to get into trouble was Bear Stearns. And then you had this – you had Ben Bernanke at the Fed. You had the Treasury Secretary, Henry Paulson, and you had Timothy Geithner, who was then president of the Federal Reserve Bank, the most important of the 12 regional banks. And as you described, these folks had to kind of operate together as an ad hoc team. To respond to these crises, we can't go through them all. But I'm kind of. But let's talk about a couple. When Bear Stearns was in trouble, at that point, the Federal Reserve actually acted to in effect salvage the company by finding a buyer and providing credit. When Lehman Brothers was in trouble 5 months later, it let the company fail. Why the inconsistency?
Well, that's a very good question. I don't think I would say that the crisis began with Bear Stearns. It really began in August 2007, but it certainly reached what looked like a crescendo in March 2008 when Bear Stearns got into trouble. It discovered that it couldn't get enough money to keep itself in business, and the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, Tim Geithner, the president, and Ben Bernanke and Hank Paulson, who was then the Treasury Secretary, decided that the system could not handle a collapse of Bear Stearns, and they couldn't find anybody to buy it without a little help from their friends at the taxpayers. So they organized a rescue of Bear Stearns where they put $30 billion, later reduced to $29 billion, of taxpayer money into this deal to take stuff off the books of Bear Stearns that the buyer, J.P. Morgan Chase, didn't want. And it was significant because it was the first public use of the Fed's power to lend to almost anybody in a crisis since the 1930s when it was given that power. And there was a great deal of debate about whether it was the right thing or the wrong thing to do. On one hand, people said they saved the system. Bear Stearns would have gone down and would have been a huge shockwave. On the other hand, other people said, well, they set a bad precedent here. And everybody will on Wall Street will take more risks because they think the Fed and the Treasury, particularly the Fed, will bail them out. So Lehman Brothers comes along and the Treasury and the Fed think, well, we can just do this same thing again. We'll find somebody else to buy Lehman and take us off our hands and we can get through this thing. Well, it turns out they can't find a buyer. The last buyer in the room is Barclays, a big British bank, and the British government in the end won't let them buy Lehman Brothers. And Mr. Bernanke and Mr. Geithner and Mr. Paulson did not come to that fateful day with a plan B. At the time, they were talking and they were open about how they thought, well, maybe the markets know that Lehman's in trouble and if we let them go, it'll teach people a lesson and it'll be bad, but it won't be catastrophic. It turns out to be pretty catastrophic. It leads all sorts of people around the world to think that no bank is safe. Lots of Americans pull money out of money market funds, and it becomes a big calamity. But Mr. Bernanke says after the fact that had he had the power and had Congress given them the money that they subsequently gave them, he would have saved Lehman Brothers because he knew that at a time like that, having a big financial house collapse would cause problems. But neither he nor Mr. Paulson nor Mr. Geithner had any idea of how many problems it would actually cause.
Now, after Lehman collapsed, of course, there were other big problems ahead. AIG got into trouble. And Bernanke, you say, took an anything-it-takes approach. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think it's important to remember that that weekend in the middle of September was pretty overwhelming, even for people who have as much power as the chairman of the Federal Reserve or the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York.
That's when Lehman was on the precipice of collapse.
Right. Yeah. But Lehman is not alone. There are three institutions in trouble. One is Merrill Lynch, and they happily marry Merrill Lynch off to Bank of America, although that doesn't turn out so well. There's Lehman. They let it go down, has a huge shockwave. But as they're letting it go down, they know they have this big problem in AIG. And AIG was really something they didn't understand very well. AIG was an insurance company. It hadn't been regulated by the Fed. They didn't appreciate just how big a mountain of hedge fund it had been built on top of its insurance operations and how many interconnections they had. Lehman goes down. They realize that they can't let AIG go down too, or we really will be on the pushing our economy into another Great Depression. So all the teach Wall Street a lesson talk vanishes, and they turn out to make a very messy deal to keep AIG from filing for bankruptcy, a mess that they're still trying to get out of.
Now, before this series of calamities that you refer, you call the Great Panic, did the character of the Fed change? I mean, did it start doing things it had never done before?
The answer to that is yes. You know, Ben Bernanke gave a speech when he was a Fed governor lecturing the Japanese about what they were doing wrong. And one of the things he recalled was that Roosevelt had this approach during the Great Depression to don't be bound by conventional tactics, try lots of things, and some of them will work and some of them won't work, but the ones that work will save you from catastrophe. And he adopted that whatever it takes approach during this period. So not only do you have them lending money to AIG and lending money to J.P. Morgan in order to buy Bear Stearns that they'd never done anything like that before, but there are all sorts of lending that they do. They lend to industrial companies that are having trouble selling short-term IOUs called commercial paper. They start buying mortgages on the open market, something they hadn't done before. All sorts of tactics, all designed to do whatever it takes so that Mr. Bernanke can keep a promise he'd once made to Milton Friedman, which was, you're right, the Fed caused the Great Depression. Thanks to you, we'll never do it again.
So it became this fountain of money, providing kind of liquidity and credit all throughout the economy. I read in a piece in the Washington Post that the Fed had provided more than $1 trillion to prop up more than 400 financial firms. Is that the scale of this?
Right. I mean, the Fed, all of its lending and all the securities now exceed $2 trillion, or they did, and now they're shrinking a little bit below $2 trillion. But one thing that's important here is that one of the reasons the Fed did this and why I use the fourth branch of government phrase is that no one else had any money to do this. You know, we learned from the J.P. Morgan experience that sometimes you need a lot of money to put out a financial fire. The Treasury and the President of the United States didn't have access to the money because Congress hadn't given it to them. The Fed was the only organization that basically had the unlimited power to spend money as long as it decided that the circumstances were, as the law provides, unusual and exigent. And so one reason why the Fed comes to the fore here is that there is no other source of financial water to put on this fire until Lehman and AIG caused Congress to actually give them some money, the $700 billion known as the TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program.
Institutions. David Wessel's new book is called In Fed We Trust. Now, I want to understand this a little more deeply. When the Fed comes up with up to $1 trillion to lend, does it simply create this by keystrokes on a computer?
Yes.
Well, so here's what's confusing about it. When the government wanted to come up with a Troubled Asset Relief Fund, they get Congress to come up with $700 billion, or the stimulus package much later, again, hundreds of billions of dollars, wouldn't it be much easier to have the Fed simply with keystrokes create money which is not part of the federal budget, not an obligation of the federal government, and not a burden to future taxpayers? Why not just do it all that way?
Well, it's a good question. So let's think about this for a minute. First of all, the Fed makes a lot of money every year, and it takes that money, the profits it makes from buying and selling government securities and other things, and gives it to the Treasury, and it reduces the federal deficit. So if the Fed loses money or makes less money, that's just less money that the government has, and some other taxes have to go up or spending has to go down. So it's not free money. Secondly, the way that this was conceived was the Fed was always willing to print money to lend to a bank as long as the bank had collateral, some securities or properties that it could give the Fed, so that if the bank couldn't pay back the loan, the Fed would get, you know, the house or the bond or something, so it would be made whole. What happens in this period is it becomes clear that a lot of the banks that want to borrow money may not be able to pay it back. They're basically broke. And the tradition is that when that happens, that's what the taxpayers do. And in every earlier banking crisis in this country and others, the taxpayers come in, buy a stake in the banks effectively. When the banks get healthy, the idea is they'll sell back they'll sell their stake and maybe they'll make some money and maybe they won't. So a line was crossed here that made a lot of people at the Fed uncomfortable. The Fed was lending money in some circumstances where the collateral was a little bit shaky and they were at risk of taking a loss. The other thing to remember to keep in mind is if the Fed creates too much money, I mean, why can't the Fed just print enough money for us all to buy Rolls Royces and enjoy a fine champagne? If the Fed prints too much money, then we get inflation, prices go up, and we have less stuff for the same amount of money. So it's not a free ride, and that's one of the things that's been a concern now.
All of the money that's gone into the economies, particularly the financial institutions, is it resulting in them increasing lending, or are they simply using it to shore up their balance sheets or pay stockholders or compensate their employees?
All of the above. One of the things that's really hard for the Fed to explain, I think, was well captured by Barney Frank, the congressman from Massachusetts who chairs the House Financial Services Committee. He said the other day, no politician ever got reelected with a bumper sticker that said, it could have been worse. And so to some extent, the Fed and the TARP money that the Treasury spends has been successful in the sense that without it, things would have been worse. But not all the institutions have increased their lending. Some of them have used the money to pay big salaries or pay out in dividends to their shareholders, and that's why there's so much controversy about it. One of the problems here is, or the dilemmas is, if you think a financial system is vital to the economy, and if the financial system implodes, everybody suffers, and we run the risk of something that looks like the Great Depression where one in four workers was out of work, then you decide you have to save the financial system for the good of everybody in the economy. But if you save the financial system, the people who are in it get bailed out. And that's what happened in this case. And one of the reasons why people are so upset is they think that some of the people who caused the problem are getting bailed out. And they're right. Some of the people who caused the problem are getting bailed out because we need them so badly, we have no choice. And that's the way the Fed looks at it. And I think the Treasury in both the Bush and the Obama administrations looks at it, although they never put it that way.
Well, Congress and the Obama administration are now considering some reforms for the financial system. There's a strong sense that we can't continue to do things as we have, that there need to be institutional protections and better regulation. What does the Obama administration contemplate for the Federal Reserve?
Well, I think everybody agrees that if you have the worst recession since the Great Depression itself, and it was caused by some explosion in the financial system, that something was wrong in the way we oversee the financial system and we ought to fix it. So I think on that, there's no controversy. The controversy comes on what we should do. What the Obama administration has said is that we would like to give the Fed a little more power. We'd like them to have the responsibility of being the overarching regulator of financial stability, working with a council of regulators so that we maybe don't find ourselves in this position again where things fall through the cracks. And they want to be sure that the Fed has the power to oversee an organization like AIG if another one grows up, which is on the edge of the banking industry but is so big or so interconnected that the Fed cannot let it fail without causing calamity. And finally, the Treasury, the Obama Treasury says, the Fed didn't do a very good job protecting consumers, so why don't we take the power away from them and create a new consumer agency that has only responsibility is to protect the consumers so that the Fed can concentrate on financial stability and interest rates and someone else can worry about consumer protection.
It's interesting that the Fed recently hired a lobbyist.
Right. The Fed has always had somebody whose job was to be a lobbyist with Congress, but that person was very low profile and wasn't from outside. Ben Bernanke, who recognizes that the Fed is under assault by Congress, that in his view, people in Congress don't understand exactly what they're doing or why they're doing it, has gone outside and hired a lobbyist, a woman who used to work for the Treasury and for a while worked, of all places, at Enron, to be his lobbyist.
And that tells you that they need to get into the game at the Hill and really play more aggressively, huh?
Well, absolutely. I mean, we see Mr. Bernanke goes up to the Hill and gets pummeled by members of Congress. And I think Mr. Bernanke and some of his colleagues at the Fed feel that they're getting pummeled unreasonably. And part of the reason they're getting pummeled unreasonably for being secretive or not transparent enough is because members of Congress, in their words, don't understand. And so the purpose of the lobbyist, they say, is to make sure that members of Congress understand. Look, there's a temptation to find villains, to find people to blame when you have a calamity like this. And the Fed, because it was so aggressive and showed itself as having so much power, has made itself a target. And now they're beginning to play defense. It's not only the lobbyist. It's you see Ben Bernanke himself going on 60 Minutes or Jim Lehrer's NewsHour, things that his predecessors never did, going over the heads of Congress to build a constituency for the Fed with the people.
Tell us what members of Congress are so angry about at the Fed.
I think different members of Congress are angry at the Fed for different things. Some people think that they fell down on the job and allowed this to happen. And those members of Congress who were urging the Fed to be more aggressive as a consumer regulator feel vindicated. Other members of Congress are upset by some of the points that you raised earlier, which is, wow, we have to go through an awful lot of work to get someone to give us permission to get a bill, and then the president has to sign it to spend $1 billion. And here's Ben Bernanke, in one weekend, $30 billion for Bear Stearns and $85 billion for AIG and now trillions of dollars and stuff. So they're saying, like, this doesn't seem right in a democracy. And then they also think, and they're reflecting, I think, the views of their constituencies, that in some cases the Fed seems to have been awfully close to the bankers it was supposed to be regulating. And they're worrying that the Fed is secretive and some kind of cabal with the bankers to not save the economy but to save Wall Street. And so there's a lot of anger at what they considered what members of Congress considered the secrecy of the Fed. Some of which is the Fed responds by saying, we're giving you more and more information. In fact, the Fed is giving out so much information now that there's a story in the Financial Times this week that says that private investors are taking advantage of the amount of information that the Fed is giving out about its portfolio in order to bet against it.
Wow.
But I think also that what's really interesting is it's a kind of suspicion of concentrated financial power that we saw in earlier episodes in American history, whether it was Alexander Hamilton's Bank of the United States or some of the Williams Jennings Bryan stuff in the years at the turn of the century, that Americans have this kind of visceral suspicion of concentrated financial power, and they worry that a central bank is too close to the commercial banks, and together they will do things that are in the interest of Wall Street, not in the interest of Main Street. And we're seeing that kind of populist anxiety, and Congress has very good antenna. When people are upset about something, Congress is upset about it. The Gallup poll did a survey a few weeks ago, and they found that fewer people think the Fed is doing a good job than thinks the IRS is doing a good job. Well, in those circumstances, you'd want a lobbyist too.
Right. Yeah, it's hard.
Probably an ad agency on top of it.
Hard to do much worse than that. If you're just joining us, our guest is David Wessel. He's the economics editor for The Wall Street Journal. He's written a new book about the Federal Reserve and the recent financial calamities. It's called In Fed We Trust. If you can put on your policy hat for a moment, I mean, how suspicious are you of this enormous concentration of power and discretion in the Fed?
I think that the crisis has exposed some difficulties in our current structure. So, for instance, a system that allows the big banks in New York to elect the board of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and then that they, with permission from the Washington, get to pick the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, who is a very important regulator, seems like something that might have made sense 100 years ago but seems offensive now. So I think it's important that the Fed be seen as acting in the interests of the country and not in the interests of the big banks, which is, of course, what Ben Bernanke repeatedly says he's doing. Secondly, I think that we do know that it's hard to always spot a crisis in advance, and we're going to make a lot of mistakes. But we didn't do a good enough job. There were enough warnings about the housing bubble and about aggressive subprime lending to people who couldn't ever afford to pay back the mortgage, and about people in buying securities they couldn't possibly understand, and everybody saying, well, it's a big bank, they must know what they're doing, and it turns out they didn't know what they're doing. So having some kind of financial stability regulator, someone who can blow the whistle loudly and who has the obligation to blow the whistle loudly, is important.
But and does it make sense to you to invest that responsibility with the Fed?
I'm not sure there's a perfect solution. That one seems as good as any given the choices at hand. But one of the things that's important and really up for debate now is how important is it to have an independent central bank? I mean, after all, we could create an agency that the president appoints the head of and the Congress confirms, and every 4 years it could change, and Congress could have up or down the right to vote their budget and make up or down decisions on whether they're doing a good job. And I think we have learned over time that having an independent central bank works pretty well in most instances, but they have to be very accountable and they have to be very open about what they're doing. And I think the Fed fell down on the job. It didn't explain very well what it was doing during the crisis, mainly because they were in a manic stage just trying to save the country. And as a result, people don't understand why they did what they did, and people are suspicious. So they have to do a better job of telling their story and explaining both to sophisticated people and regular voters, this is what we're doing and this is why we're doing it. Otherwise, they'll always be accused of either bailing out the rich guys, or the markets will be very confused and they will say, we're not sure what the rules that the Fed is playing by, and if they don't make their rules clear, we won't understand the rules we should play by.
You know, there's a bill by the libertarian Ron Paul to give Congress's, you know, auditing arm, the Government Accountability Office, the authority to audit the Fed. And I'm wondering to what extent it's one thing for the Fed to not say what it's doing as it's doing it, particularly when it's, you know, when it's in the midst of a crisis. But to what extent does it disclose what it has done? For example, this $1 trillion that was loaned to all these companies, are all those transactions a matter of public record?
Right. So it's important to understand what the controversy is over that bill. Ron Paul has proposed this bill, and more than half the members of the House of Representatives have co-sponsored it. The issue isn't whether the Fed should be audited. The Fed is audited by the GAO, except in the decisions it makes on interest rates and monetary policy. The change would be that the Fed would be audited on that function as well. And the Fed says if Congress audits that is, if Congress can come in and say, you moved interest rates on Tuesday, why did you do it? And then they will be able to second-guess the Fed. And Mr. Bernanke says that that would cross the line and the Fed would no longer be independent within the government to make interest rate decisions and that bad things would happen as a result. So the controversy is it sounds innocuous, audit the Fed, but the real question is, does Congress have the right to go in and second-guess these interest rate decisions?
Ben Bernanke has been really active on, you know, talk shows. He was on 60 Minutes. He's done town hall meetings. And as you said, part of that is a defense of the institution and its independence. It also happens that his term comes up in January and he could be reappointed by the president. How safe is he, do you think?
Well, I think you're absolutely right that it's a two-pronged approach. He would say, if he were sitting here, that he's doing it all to explain to people how the institution worked, and given their role, it's important that people understand, and so forth. It's kind of ironic that he's making himself so much the symbol of the Fed, since one of his goals when he came in, when he replaced Alan Greenspan in 2006, was to be the un-Greenspan and to make the Fed more the subject of this attention rather than the chairman. That's an approach he's chucked. It's obvious that it has the added benefit to him of making it easier for the president to reappoint him, although Mr. Bernanke doesn't admit that. I think if the president had to make a decision right now, he would probably reappoint Mr. Bernanke. You know, you can bet on this online on a website called Intrade, and they've been giving odds of 65% that Mr. Bernanke will be reappointed when his term is up at the end of January. And I think the reason is quite simple. While Mr. Obama might prefer to have his own person in there, perhaps somebody like Larry Summers, his economic advisor, there's a lot of costs to changing the Fed chairmen in the middle of a weak economy. People in the bond market will be uncertain what the new guy is going to be like, and that can lead to higher interest rates at an inconvenient moment. But I also think that there may be some advantage to the president to be seen as reappointing someone who was put in place by his Republican predecessor, because the United States owes a lot of money to a lot of people around the world, and those people may be suspicious, the Chinese, for instance, if the president puts one of his own people there, and they'll think, oh, my God, they're going to run up the deficit and they're going to have inflation and they'll dump their securities. And while that probably would not be the case if anybody Mr. Obama appointed, the perception would be there. So my guess is if the president had to make the decision right this minute, he'd reappoint him. So if he's going to do that, why hasn't he said it? Well, because he wants the option of changing his mind if the economy falls apart in the next couple of months and he needs someone to blame. Mr. Bernanke, a Bush appointee, will be a convenient target.
Well, David Russell, what's your sense of where the economy is now? Is this a recovery?
The best thing about where we are right now in the economy is we've pulled back from the abyss. When I talked to Ben Bernanke in the fall of 2008, during the worst of the crisis, he was afraid that we were on the verge of what he called Depression 2.0. Well, that's passed. And so now we see the economy is no longer contracting at a frightening rate. It's not yet begun to grow, but it's looking closer to that moment than ever before. I think the most likely scenario is that it'll grow so slowly that we'll still have high unemployment for a couple of years, maybe as high as 10%. So it's going to be very uncomfortable recovery, although there's a bit more optimism today than there was a week ago on that among some economists. So I would say we're near the point of recovery, but it's going to be a painfully slow recovery.
Well, David Wessel, it's been really interesting. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
David Wessel is economics editor of The Wall Street Journal. His new book is called In Fed We Trust. Deep in the Amazon jungle, there's a ruined town that sets its clocks to Detroit time. The town is called Fordlandia, which is also the title of award-winning historian Greg Grandin's book on Henry Ford's grand plan to build a shining city in the jungle. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Given GPS systems in our cars and Google Earth maps on our personal computers, it seems like there isn't a square inch left on this planet that hasn't been surveyed. But even if the world's remotest regions have been charted, there are stories about those places that remain unexplored. That's the thrill that historian Greg Grandin's new book, Fordlandia, gives a reader. The all-too-rare thrill of discovery. Or I guess I should say rediscovery, because once upon a time, most Americans had heard something in the newspaper or on newsreels about Henry Ford's attempt in the late 1920s to build a version of Main Street, USA, deep in the Amazon jungle of Brazil. Ford's all-American town, with its Cape Cod cottages and red fire hydrants, its hospital, swimming pools, and golf course, gradually gave way to the encroaching vines, vipers, and damp of the Amazon. In 2005, when Grandin first visited the ruins of Fordlandia, still an 18-hour journey by riverboat from the nearest provincial city, a few elderly residents still remained who remembered the gleaming city that was, and they spoke glowingly of Mr. Ford and his vision. Grandin is both an academic authority on Central and South America and a compelling storyteller. He's written a fascinating narrative history not only of Fordlandia, but also of Henry Ford's later career, when the nightmarish aspects of the assembly line revolution that he'd created bedeviled him. As Grandin tells it, the official story behind the founding of Fordlandia was commercial. Henry Ford wanted to grow rubber trees to supply tires for the cars his plants were churning out. But that was the rational excuse for a project that was much more utopian in its ambitions. Ford, then in his 60s, had begun to look backward in the 1920s to a pre-industrial golden age in America. The mechanized horrors of World War I and later troubles on the home front, particularly the rise of his foe, Franklin Roosevelt, and the backlash he'd begun to receive for his anti-Semitic tirades, had deeply unnerved him. Grandin traces how Ford began escaping into the past by collecting antiques and founding rustic villages in Michigan that evoked the farm community of his childhood. When Brazilian officials dangled land in front of Ford, he saw a chance to begin the world anew. In 1927, Ford snapped up a parcel in the Amazon basin, roughly the size of the state of Connecticut. For the next decade or so, the father of standardized parts and sparkling factory cleanliness lost millions in an epic battle with the chaos that is the Amazon jungle. Grandin says that the first years of the settlement were plagued by waste, violence, and vice, making Fordlandia more Deadwood than our town. Indeed, the stories he tells of Ford men in their ties and white linen suits going native are, well, just wild. In 1929, for instance, a trusted employee dispatched into the jungle to gather rubber seeds wound up ignoring Ford's prohibition against alcohol, getting semi-permanently drunk, and proceeding to go around baptizing cows and pigs with bottles of perfume he'd gotten from a trading post. Especially interesting is Grandin's account of the native laborers' resistance to the strictures of industrial time. Whistles and time clocks were foreign to workers, who measured time by the sun and seasons. After a riot destroyed the first settlement, order was imposed and a Disneyfied town took shape in the jungle, with 400 clapboard houses, shops, and an open-air dance hall, where wholesome minuets and polkas prevailed. Ford disapproved of the sex dancing that was then sweeping America. Fordlandia, Grandin explains, never quite succeeded. Leaf blight and insects decimated the closely planted rubber trees, and perhaps of special insult to the virulently anti-union Ford, the rubber plantation workers successfully unionized themselves in 1939, years before the UAW negotiated a contract with his River Rouge plant in Michigan. One final historical irony that Grandin excavates is that in 1941, Ford even gave tacit permission to FDR's Committee on Political Refugees to resettle European Jews at the failing Fordlandia. Like the overriding plan of escape that inspired Fordlandia, nothing ever came of it.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Fordlandia, The Rise and Fall of Henry Ford's Forgotten Jungle City by Greg Grandin.